Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I apologize today if I'm a little bit under the weather or odd, because I feel strangely discombobulated, and I'm feeling very filled with rage against the machine at the moment. But I'm joined today, hopefully to lighten me up and keep me cheerful, by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm well, thanks, Nick, and I think listeners can really relate to that feeling if they've ever had any sort of, you know, average type engagement with the state. So, you know, they always say relate to your audience. So far, so good.
Yeah. No, I know I'm definitely not alone. it's just feeling particularly strongly today. And Mr. Gabriel Krauser, Gabriel, how are you?
Jolly good. Yeah. No, I'm excited about some of the campaigns work we're doing. Watch the space. You had a wonderful podcast yesterday, and next week we're going to be coming out with some.
Right. So do check out yesterday's episode, and yeah, you'll see more from us on our campaign in the coming days. I think we've got a press briefing on our episode yesterday, tomorrow, and the report will be published. So that'll be good stuff. Okay. So part of the reason for why I'm rather annoyed right now at our state is that the ever useful, or maybe not ever useful, Competition Commission has decided that it needs to launch an investigation into several companies in South Africa, because it is concerned that with the increasing role of e-commerce and online marketplaces, that uncompetitive practices are perhaps creeping into these new industries, and that there's too much dominance by certain companies. So the Competition Commission says that it's going to be launching investigations into the following companies, which it says have possible cause for concern for anti-competitive behavior. They include companies like Takealot, the online retailer, Mr. D and Uber Eats, in the food delivery app platform. I don't know what that industry is properly called, Airbnb, which is the market leader in home sharing accommodation, Auto Trader, cars.co.za, Property 24, Android and Google, and the Google Play, as well as the Apple App Store, because Apple users are not allowed to download apps from any other store. So they said, online markets have become increasingly important channel for business to reach consumers, a trend which has accelerated under the COVID-19 pandemic and which is likely to continue. Online markets provide consumers with the convenience of comparing a wide range of options and then safely purchasing online. And so they said that for this reason, the inquiry is a proactive measure for the commission to get a greater understanding of the online markets operating in South Africa and whether there are factors which may be hindering competition or undermining public interest. So let me start with you, Gabriel. I get a very sick feeling in my stomach when I read this, because I assume that in 5 months they're going to publish a report, and then we're going to get a wonderful group of regulations which will strangle business and make it even more difficult to get by in South Africa. Am I being too cynical?
Well, Nick, if you're looking for a medicine to make that sense of nausea go away, then I think you should read the Mail and Guardian. Let me grant that there is one semblance of a good idea here. It is the case that there is something uncomfortable about things like the Apple App Store, where you have app stores, software producers, hardware providers, all syncing up with these environments that don't allow for competition from outside, not by legal means. They're not legally disallowing it. They just sort of create these ecosystems. I don't think that regulation is the way out of it myself, but I can see how reasonable people suppose that it might be helpful. So that's one thing, and let's put that to the side. The rest is just ludicrous. The thought that Property 24, which is in open competition with a whole bunch of other websites for finding accommodation, including Airbnb. And I know this because I have recently been on the market to find rental accommodation. Where do you go? You check out Craigslist, you check out Property 24, you check out Airbnb. They're all in direct competition with each other. There's no one who's got a monopoly there. There's no way for a monopoly, an unfair monopoly, to be created. The same with Uber. You can Bolt, Uber Eats, you can go for Mr. Delivery, you can order from the restaurant directly. I mean, I use the Uber Eats app. They're not paying me to say so, because I find it's the most hassle-free. I don't have to talk to anyone. And honestly, when I'm ordering lunch or dinner and I'm busy working, then I don't want to talk to someone and phone them on the phone. That's just me. Different people can do different things. So given that, is it reasonable to suppose that the Competition Commission will come out and say, no, there's no problem here. There's open competition. Well, here's why you might think not. And here's where I think Nicholas's sense of foreboding comes from. Last year, during the lockdown, at its hardest levels, not only were bikinis and open-toned shoes banned, not only were cigarettes and all kinds of things banned, we also had e-commerce shut down for a while. And the explanation given by the Commands Council was basically, I mean, it had a couple of parts, but one of those parts was that there are too many white people who own online retail. And so we're going to exacerbate apartheid-era inequalities if we don't also shut these businesses down and don't think too hard about all the consumers of all races and all the workers of all races who are going to be badly, badly affected by this in the midst of the greatest job-shedding episode that this country's ever experienced. So that kind of anti-pragmatic, sclerotic offense against the right to work and provide a service to others is already now part of the background. But it's only one part. We don't have to go very far back into history. We can just look at the latest fantastic competition push coming from the post office looking for a monopoly in open terms. To stop white monopoly capital, what we need is government. Actual monopolies where only the post office, which couldn't find a letter that was put alone on a table in front of it and send it to the right person. I mean, our colleague Terence Corrigan ordered some toys from America, or important memorabilia, whatever you call it. It took 10 days to get from America to South Africa and then 4 months to get from one side of Joburg to the other side, which was nicely broadcast on ENCA. We appreciate that. This same post office is now going to have a monopoly on all of the kinds of things that Uber Eats and Takealot trade in. I've just ordered a mouse online because of my Fandango trying to run the show in Nicholas's absence last week. So I need a new mouse. I go to Takealot. Well, that package weighs less than a kilogram, I hope. And so I would have to rely on the post office. And then one might never have another mouse other than in the garden again. So combine these two things as with ICASA's track record of, for example, interfering in one of the larger sort of entertainment sector financial resources in the country, which is people's desire to watch sport and try and basically expropriate the intellectual property rights purchased by MultiChoice and Discovery, MultiChoice and DStv channels within that, so that the government can get free broadcasting of popular British sports without paying for it. I'm getting into the weeds here. There's a long track record which shows that the actors involved have a dubious record and that the odds, the stakes are extremely high. Crush online retail in this country and you undermine one of the few industries to have survived the last year, relatively intact, and one of the best prospects for growth into what we call the fourth industrial revolution, but probably should be called in South Africa just straightforward second wave industrialization.
Yeah, no, I agree completely with that. Whatever reasonable arguments there might be for some sort of regulation here or there or some sort of practice here or there, this is The track record is really bad on this. And, I think across the world, we've seen a lot of special interest groups over the last couple of decades capturing industries and capturing regulators and, stifling innovation, except in the place of the internet, where it's kind of been like a wild west. And that's had some good things about it and it's had some bad things about it. But I think it's been a pretty good thing overall. Herman, Uber Eats is something in South Africa which really works, and I just picked my mom up from a vaccination center which is being run by the government in South Africa, and let's just say I don't really want the people who just ran that center, as she told me they did, to also be running my food delivery. What's your take on this?
Well, the first thing is that if we look a year ago, we will encounter some bizarre government notions that people aren't allowed to hand out charitable food parcels. So let's be honest, the government's priority to get food to people isn't massively high. So I'm not surprised it doesn't like Uber Eats. I mean, it barely likes just, you know, Eats. So one thing that I have to put on the table here, and it's something that I'm, you know, what was it that Barack Obama did on gay marriage? He evolved. I think I'm in some evolution or going through some sort of episode, possibly, related to the absolutism of the free market. I've been reading now for many, many months, because sometimes I'm a very slow reader. I don't have a moderate setting. I either finish a book in a day or you know, I commit a decade to it. And I've been struggling for a long while with the only English language biography of Ludwig Erhard that I could find. And he was the minister of economics in West Germany immediately after the Second World War. And it's largely due to his policies and the circumstances they created that allowed for the so-called Wirtschaftswunder, the working miracle, to occur. And really, within 15 years of being a meter deep in rubble, the German economy rose to become the fastest growing economy, not only in Europe, but also to be one of the dominant and important economies across the world, achieving living standards that, you know, would have been ridiculous even a century before that. So, and Erhard was what one would call an ordo-liberal. That ordo probably, I haven't looked into this, but I'm just assuming etymologically it is from order, you know, probably some Greek word for order. So they and it's very clear that while Erhard didn't consider himself to be terribly ideological, one would say this was his ideological position. And what ordo liberalism essentially means economically is you need a strong regulating state to stimulate or simulate market conditions to the advantage of the consumer. And in the 21st century, I started reading about order liberalism with some skepticism, but I am starting to develop some sympathy for the idea, especially if we look at the massive, you know, Google and Facebook, the real tech giants, being in control of so many channels of commerce. So, cards on the table, I think there is a debate to be had for the state having some relationship to the health of competition in a market, especially in the tech age that we are, where it is so easy for one tech giant to cannibalize enough of its competition, play on the personal financial benefit that the owner would get, so as to reach a point of such imbalance that no competition becomes feasible. So I have sympathy that there's a debate to be had on this, but this is not the debate that we're looking at, because as Gabriel pointed out, Property 24 is not in a closed market. There is no, to my knowledge, government regulation on whether you might start your own property app or website and allow agents or real estate people to list their property on your site. So it is a free market. Clearly, there's the ability for people to challenge that monopoly. Now, the perversion comes in if you look at the purpose of the Competition Commission as stated on their website. To promote efficiency, lol, adaptability, second lol, development of the economy. I'm just going to stop counting the lols. Provide consumers with competitive prices and product choices, promote employment and advance the social and economic welfare of South Africans, expand opportunities for South African participation in world markets, and recognize the role of foreign competition. I mean, it goes on like that for a bit, but the point is, this is at such odds with...
You know, Herman, yeah. I think there's a monopoly that they should probably take a look at, because I think they might have some work to do there in breaking it up, and it's called ESCOM. And it's the reason I didn't have power for 6 hours last night. So,
yes, and just as an aside, it's a unique skill to be able to have an unassailable monopoly and make a loss on something like power provision. It's not a niche good that people might want to buy. So to conclude my whole spiel and rambling shebang here is, yes, I think competitiveness is something that can't be left to the market itself fully. We see that, sadly, over the last 2 years of the engagements that the IRR has had with corporate South Africa, who, if they could, would rig every system in their favor. And the toxic marriage between state and corporate South Africa is doing that. The problem I have here is that there's no obvious loss. If there's a problem to be solved and competitive, you know, rigging of the game is the solution, let's define the problem first. As far as I can understand, the Competition Commission's only problem here is market dominance. And that's not a problem. That is an indication of preference and market performance. If they can point to some malevolent activities by these entities to disproportionately or unfairly dominate the market, yeah, I'd be one of their cheerleaders. But that's not what's going on here. So let's, as you and Gabriel have pointed out, an idea must be considered in some terms of its practicality from whence it comes. And here we have the friends of, you know, people like Ebrahim Patel. I'm sorry, if you trust them, you are being incredibly foolish.
Right. So, to be fair, they haven't published anything yet as to what they recommend should be done. So, one could give them the benefit of the doubt in some cases and hope, perhaps, that they're not going to, publish some terrible recommendations. But we shall see, and we shall, of course, keep an eye on it. And if they do, we shall campaign against that because it's silly and it hurts the people of South Africa. Anyway, let's move on abroad. To I think what is quite an interesting story, and I know that's one that that's really got Gabriel interested, and this is, so we talked a little bit last week about the Israel-Palestine conflict, and we're going to focus a little bit more today, not so much really on the conflict necessarily, but on the media and specifically the Associated Press. So this is following a article written in The Atlantic, which is a prestigious American magazine, by Matty Friedman, where he talks about what he sees as conflicts of interest and bias in the Associated Press, which I believe he used to work for, with regards to reporting issues in the Israel-Palestine conflict. Gabriel, what are your thoughts on this piece and what the claims being made here are?
Yeah, so Friedman is making this charge that there is bad media bias coming from people who are smart enough, well-funded enough, and globally secure enough that they should be doing a better job. I think part of what's interesting about the story that he tells is it's not this kind of thing that we're used to in South Africa where things go wrong because someone's being paid to do the wrong thing. It's not corruption in that sense. Rather, it's a series of mistakes that over time accumulate to create a really indefensible position, but where if you zoom in on any particular issue, you can sort of almost see how a reasonable person might have gone this way. So he describes his experience working at the AP and, you know, these fresh young journalists who don't really know what to do, and they arrive in this war-torn region, and who do they end up hanging out with? Well, all the other journalists and the expats who live there for a few months and then leave. And these people have only but the most superficial attitude towards the Palestinians that they're living around because they don't really engage with them. They just talk about them at cocktail parties and how difficult life here is. And so these journalists start marinating in a worldview that treats Palestinians as agentless victims and Israelis as white apartheid supremacists. And even if they're a bit circumspect, that's all the evidence that they're really getting. And I've got a lot of sympathy for young people who kind of end up having slightly biased views onto the world, because I'm still young enough that I think I've got some biases onto the world. And I know from experiences of moving here and there and talking to new people that I've learned, oh my word, I had a big blind spot. So there, Friedman's not saying, look, these are terrible people. He's sort of giving a sense of how the cocktail circuit in these war-torn regions. And it's, I mean, I haven't been there, but I have been in the cocktail circuit in Rwanda, and it really is another planet. And if you sort of live in, if you move in parts of Cape Town, you know, everyone's got a German accent or a French accent or a British accent. And South Africa really is another country, but people have strong views about it, you know. And if you imagine living in that for a year as a professional, I think you'd come out with some bad ideas. Okay, so that's the nice side. The heavy side on
can
the other end of it.
Can I say something, Gabriel? Please. I think I'm adopting Gabriel's idea, but I think what you're describing here is the strength of esteem teams, because you participate for so long in a specific esteem environment that the social cost of not adapting to those ideas becomes unpayable.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And that's where it goes from being naive and it's not your fault to being really bad. Like, if you realize that you're putting out lies or a very one-sided form of the truth, and that if you change that pattern, then some people are going to say, oh, you're a terrible Zionist. Well, then you must do it. If it's the truth, that's your job. That's your journalistic ethic, is to take the slings and arrows of criticism. But not everyone has the strength to do that. Now, if you start with this little vignette, and this piece is like a 25-minute read, so I'm not going to sum it all up, but he starts kind of there, and he ends up with the AP having its journalists harassed by Hamas, a terrorist organization, in the AP building and not reporting on it. The AP knowing for a fact that Hamas has ordered in another 100 rockets and managed to smuggle them in to their region and not reporting on that, even while reporting on comments by the Israeli army to the effect that such rockets are being imported, and then saying, no, but there's no evidence for this. So that's really a cover-up. To the final cover-up, the AP knowing that rocket launch sites are being installed literally in their building is his hardest allegation, and then not reporting on that. And then the AP gets bombed. I'm laughing. I mean, it's tragic. It's terrible. It's just so ironic. I don't know how to process it emotionally. And because the rocket sites are being gone after, and then not knowing how to square that story. Because now the chickens have proverbially come home to roost. So it's just a journalist's tale. It's something to look at, to try and think about how the media works and how good people. I see a lot of good people on Facebook really talking rubbish about this Israeli-Palestinian conflict because they're getting their information. I trust the AP. I think it's the best journalism institution in the world. And this is not changing my mind about that, because I don't think that the same problems happen at all of their offices. But if you don't have the time and you just see a little bit of the truth coming out of a place that's really gotten very contorted and very esteem bound around its own loyalism and ideologies, then you will find yourself punting nonsense as well. And I think that's bad for yourself. It's bad for everyone. And this story, I think, should, if you read the story, I think for a year to come, everything else that you read, you're gonna do so leaning back with your skeptical mind tuned in. And that's absolutely how you should read things, including in the Daily Friend, including from myself and all of my colleagues. You must read us skeptically, because that's the only way that you are ultimately the only guardian of your mind. And I think that this article really shows how if you let that slip, things can go badly, badly wrong.
I was talking to someone and they mentioned that they were watching the social media coverage actually of the Israeli strike on the AP building in real time. And until the Jerusalem Post mentioned that the Israelis had struck a Hamas site there, it did appear as if the AP and, I can't remember, I think it was Al Jazeera, who were also in the building, were very much leaving the context out of the strike and suggesting that it was a strike on them. It was kind of a lie by omission. Now, you can't really prove that, and subsequently, you know, the story has gotten more complex. But that was the initial way it came out from their side on social media. And in light of this report here, I would not be terribly surprised if there was some playing fast and loose with the rules there. Herman, your thoughts on this? Media bias and esteemed teams in general. My question to you, Herman, is perhaps, you know, if the cocktail circuit is so bad for journalism, maybe the solution is to have sort of disheveled, hairy journalists walking around, smoking and drinking heavily and not really hanging out with the cool crowd.
Yes, and then having aggressive mainstream journalists challenge whether these people are in fact journalists. So I think the first thing I have to say is I don't know enough of the Israel-Palestine situation to hold any strong opinions either way. I move in a specific, you know, esteem team, if you will, where a dominant pro-Israeli attitude is the norm. So if I have a bias, it would be in that direction. But I genuinely don't know enough to have an informed opinion on this. And the reason is, I think if, on something like this, you're either an expert or a bullshitter or a journalist. So you're either someone who fundamentally studies the problems, you're either someone who bullshits because you think you get, you know, some cred somewhere, or you just report the basic facts. People like me are dependent on the basic facts because I don't have the knowledge or the skills or the time to become an expert, and I don't have the inclination, this might come as a surprise to many, to be a bullshitter. So I'm reliant on objective, factual reporting. And I think a word that has died in the media is reporting. We only talk about journalism, and journalism has sort of this this tinge of activism in it, where reporting is actually the good old find the facts, present them. Find the facts, present them. So this is a crisis of journalism because I think journalism inherently has become activist and the idea of reporting has died out. And a last point I very quickly want to make is never let anyone underestimate the value of the battle of ideas, because this is a 50-year battle of ideas we're looking at here, at least, where an attitude has become appealing. An idea has become appealing. It has permeated throughout organic spheres of influence to reach a point where I wouldn't be surprised if the United Nations were to officially adopt a policy or a position critical of the one side or the other. And it all starts, yes, it took a long time, but it all starts with those cocktail circuits when the fashionability of an idea became ultimately a weapon of propaganda because the people behind it knew how ideas are powerful. So my two cents. Number one is I'm being dropped because I don't get the reporting I need, so I can't form a sensible opinion. And the second thing is this shows the power of ideas. It's abstract. It's sometimes awkward to explain to people. So what is it you do, Herman? But the permeation and the advocacy of good ideas is the only real way to reverse this sort of perverse public sphere that we see playing out aggressively around us.
So can I just split a hair in the last sort of 30 seconds or so? And I think that one can, at least in theory, be an activist and a journalist, but your activism must never come before the journalism and the reporting of basic facts and exactly. truths and not omitting things. And unfortunately, you know, for the, you know, there's a long history of journalists being activists and trying to take down, I don't know, a crime boss or a corrupt politician or something. But yes. when they lie or when they omit or when, you know, it becomes unthinkable to report a certain fact, that's when you cross the line and you become too much an activist and not at all a journalist.
I was reminded today, if I can come in here, I was reminded today of John Kane Berman, our grand emeritus former leader, who was often confronted by this issue, with the Institute of Race Relations being the foremost anti-apartheid think tank and trying to work on two fronts. The one is reporting facts, scrutinizing every aspect of apartheid it's iniquities, it's injustices, and putting that so that, as he puts it, no South African could say they didn't know. That was fundamental to the mission. And another part of the mission is to try and make the human arguments that we can work together, that we can respect one another, that we can hold on to the content of character as being the standard of finding one another in social space. Mm. And that does require activism and outreach programs and, you know, scholarship programs. Okay, Mandela gets a scholarship from the IRR. That's fantastic. Does that mean we can't tell the truth? No, it doesn't. And the way he put it very succinctly is, we have a viewpoint. We've always had this viewpoint. We will always have this viewpoint, and our enemies must know that. But we will never repress facts that contradict or undermine our viewpoint. Yes. That's what distinguishes us. We are not afraid of the truth.
Yes.
And we do not want you to be afraid of the truth either. If there's an inconvenient truth, you must hear it. And the best place to hear it will be from us.
I think it's right. The...
Herman, we don't have time, I'm afraid, to carry on. I think, in fact, that's a good note to end off on. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. And we will see you tomorrow for another episode of The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.